Hi, I'm Jen Dobby, and this is Flip the Focus, the show that tells unexpected stories of tech. Welcome to a new season, season two. We're expanding the conversation. We're diving into the biggest challenges being solved by tech, while we continue to shine a light on the incredible women leading the way, particularly in Australia's tech scene. So thanks so much for all the feedback that you gave us on our first season. I promise you we read every review and every comment across our Flip the Focus podcast page on Apple and also in our listeners group. And I should say, drop me a DM on LinkedIn if you're keen to join the listener group. It's a really good community. So the heart of the show will stay the same. We're keeping AI and innovation at the center of every conversation. And that's while we're embracing a broader range of voices and perspectives to make sure we're growing our learning with you. As ever, we're going to be all about diving deeper into discussions around the topics and issues facing us all today. And this season really focuses on getting into how tech is helping to solve each of those big and curly issues. And every time, we'll still give you what you need to know to take action and make tech a more inclusive place to work and to thrive. Speaking of being more inclusive, this feels like a really good time to introduce you to someone who's been behind the scenes on Flip the Focus for a while now, and that is my lovely producer, Nico. Hey, Nico.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for having me on here.
Of course. I mean, you've been here the whole time. It's just that no one else knew you were here.
That is true. I have listened to many an hour of Jen's voice for this podcast.
Well, and I think now the only logical repayment for that is that we get to hear some of yours, hey?
Luckily, I'm editing it, so it means I can cut myself out.
You can cut yourself out and start making yourself look like an absolute rock star. I'll be watching out for that. Everyone else, keep your ears open for that. If we spot any of that, we've got to call Nico on it. But listen, in all seriousness, I guess Nico and I spent many hours talking through all of the research and the edits for each of the episodes in the first season. And as part of that, we started having these really long conversations, and I found that Nico would ask me questions I'd never have thought about, or he'd present opinions on guests and episodes, which really made me stop and think. And we even got teary at some of the stories together. Nico was completely stunned that tech is still in so many ways such an uneven industry to take part in, particularly as a woman or minority. And look, it started to play on my mind that you should be hearing these conversations too, so that we can all ask those questions together and look for answers into these tech industries, really curly issues together. So with that in mind, I guess it's worth us talking a little bit about this episode. So season two, episode one, we recorded this really late last year, so 2024, before the US election had taken place. So I think it's worth noting that this conversation does talk around demanding and expecting more equality and diversity. And I think that's taken on an even more urgent tone now, given the outcome of the election and the way the world has moved quite quickly after that. I think it's worth us kind of bearing in mind that when we listen to the conversation. Now, this conversation, episode one of season two, is myself speaking with Kate Tolliner. Kate is IBM's Director of Government and Enterprise for ANZ. And honestly, I found her completely compelling. What she talks so interestingly about is the real world impact of AI, specifically in organizations with major reach and resources. Now, Kate's got more than 20 years of experience across the Australian Army, and then she switched to the corporate world. And she's very much been at the pointy end of real world decision making with AI. And I think what came to bear during our conversation is it's clear that those experiences have really given her a very thought provoking view on the intersection of AI and humanity, and on ultimately where all that machine learning is going to take us. What did you make of the Etnico?
Yeah, I think one of the things that struck me at first was something that she said, where AI is not a new thing. It has been around for 40 odd years. Yes, at the moment, it's a new shiny toy that everyone has to play with, but it's not that new. Yes, everyone can generate a giraffe flying on magic carpets. Not that they need to, but they can. So it's on some of it, it's a fun tool, but I don't think it's not this new thing that everyone should be scared of that we all seem to be reading about in the papers.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that that was definitely one of the kind of leading topics that Kate was so fascinating on, is, you know, the newness or not of AI. And I think from memory, I think it's 1966, the first, you know, really well-known example of AI that she talks to. And that definitely made me stop and think as well. There's lots of different rabbit holes that Kate and I go down together. And I think that it's certainly, you know, made me think about AI in a completely different way. I think that at heart, Kate comes across as a pragmatic optimist, probably, around the future of AI and its possibility for roles in STEM and for gender diversity and for humanity generally. Look, she's definitely got some pretty spicy takes on AI itself. And Nico, to your point, like whether or not it's as simple as it being this massive game changer, you know, the current narrative that we're looking at. So I think, look, without much more talking about it, let's get into the conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Nico and I are so excited to share this next series of conversations with you. Let's get into the interview with Kate and Flip the Focus. Lovely to see you, Kate. How are you?
Hi, Jen. I'm well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to speak with you today. And thank you so much for the work that you're doing to amplify female voices in this very important sector.
Thanks, Kate. We're so excited to have you here too. So let's get into it and flip the focus. I want to talk a little bit about the foundations around AI, because AI is absolutely the conversation that everybody's having in tech right now. But honestly, you know, recently it's omnipresent, but it's not really new tech at all, is it?
No, it's not. And I love the question because AI has been with us for a really long time, since the 1950s and 1960s in various kinds of technologies. And I've loved Stella Soller's work from the National AI Center that talks about the history of AI. I learned about the history of AI when I was doing this study and was taken with one of the first chatbots that was created, which was called Eliza in 1966. And Eliza was a chatbot that interacted with someone on a keyboard. The program was a kind of very early mental health triaging program. So users would interact, and Eliza was on an if-then programming script that would really just feed back the statement that had been typed into it. So they would say, well, why are you feeling blue, or why are you feeling sad? And it's a really interesting case study. And then we've just continued to develop over the decades. And now we're really in a state where so much AI is already embedded and we're working with it all the time in our daily lives, from everything from Google Maps to digital assistants to ChatGPT, helping with education and just helping us make our lives a little bit easier, really, which I think is the intent, helping us with our decision making. But of course, it's brought about this huge national, international conversation about what is AI and what does it mean for us? What does it mean for us as humans?
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting that you raise that, you know, the intent of AI. You know, we're in a situation now where oftentimes the dialogue is rightly around, you know, where are we differing from the intent of AI to the reality of the AI, and the uses that it's being used for at the moment. I think, you know, if we look, for example, you mentioned ChatGPT, if we look at OpenAI, you know, very clearly stated that they're there to, you know, help humanity. I think the interesting conversation then becomes, you know, but once AI is open to human nature and the whims of humans who are using it, particularly around generative AI, which is, you know, self-perpetuating and self-taught, where does that go?
Yes, absolutely. And they say that tech is a mirror of ourselves. So it reflects all of our biases and hopes and dreams. And tech organizations are expending a huge amount of resource on retraining their AI models so they're more accurate and they don't hallucinate and they don't project a whole lot of bias and inaccuracies about the world, and spending probably not as much money as they should, but spending a lot of money on content moderation, because a lot of the part of humanity is free will and being able to express ourselves, and we know that there's a whole range of views that are online, but that requires a whole lot of cleanup in order to meet community standards or standards that we would expect from some of these service providers.
Something really interesting you said there, and it's a relatively new phrase to me as well. Talk to us a bit about AI hallucination. Explain what that means and why it's problematic.
Sure. So a hallucination is really an inaccuracy. And there's a lot of discussion about whether the term hallucination is correct for what we're describing, because people hallucinate, but whether an AI program, whether a software tool can hallucinate or can have a human response in its programming, something is contested. But really, it's an inaccuracy. So something that ChatGPT or any of the LLM or generative AI tools have been criticized for is that it gives its responses in authoritarian terms. So it projects itself to be correct and won't often say, I don't know. If it doesn't know, it will generate some sort of text that is programmed to best answer the question in what the inferencing or the rationalization bounds allow it to. So hallucinations can be overcorrected. We saw that with one of the large tech organizations that was trying to make sure that it was representing a diversity of views and then started incorrectly showing some artistic representations of things that had not happened in history for people. And so it just requires a very healthy amount of critical thinking, I think, for users and for everyone that's interacting, as well as designers and implementers, is to strive for accuracy with these tools, but also to have a big fat disclaimer that they're not 100% accurate and that things need to be fact-checked.
Okay, so Kate, we've gotten into some detail now about history and background and kind of the broader theory around AI. So what I'd love to do now is get into the realities of it and how we're living with it in the present. What I want to do is take us back to basics. So can you tell us about applied AI? And let's take it from the beginning and really get into it. When somebody says applied AI, what does that actually mean?
Thanks, Jen, for the question. I think it's a great question because this is all about how, you know, we live and work and how that we interact, you know, with each other and the way that we work. So this could be everything from just apps on our phone or the way that we study, the tools that we use to conduct our research, the way that AI can help us organize our day through a kind of digital assistant that can tell us how many emails we have and what we should prioritize and respond to first. It is ubiquitous, I think, this technology in our lives, but also really helpful for us to just occasionally take a beat and have a think about the ways that we're shaped and the way that we're shaping this kind of technology.
Yeah, I love that. So I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding of it is then a couple of conversations that are going on at the moment, and one of them is around the theory of AI, and that being particularly with generative AI, the technology is moving so fast, we must be having conversations around the governance of it, what the future of it looks like, and how we make sure it develops for good. Then on the other hand, applied AI is literally AI that we are using already. So it's not part of this broader conversation. It's literally, what are we using every day? What's already happening in our homes, in our lives, and at work that we're using AI for? Is that right? Have I got that right?
I think that's a perfect distinction. And I completely agree around the governance requirement, those guardrails and controls that we need to be, that, you know, have been in place now. We've been putting them in place for quite some time with an accelerated strategic push from government in terms of the way that government will interact with these kind of programs. So yes, I think that's really nicely summarized, and there's kind of the individual and society aspect here as well. So organizations have corporate responsibility in terms of their social license to operate and need to be using AI in responsible and safe ways.
I think that's so interesting, you know, what we do with AI, what we're using it for in our lives, we are just as responsible. And also that can be a really positive thing. You know, we choose to download a particular app or interact with a particular desktop application. That's on us. And I think it's something that leads us nicely into that conversation around women, particularly in AI. Do you think that within applied AI, are we building it together to have more women in the room? Do you think that's happening right now?
I think in pockets. I think we've got a way to go before we achieve critical mass in terms of design and iterative design of these apps and of the things that we need in order to help our lives be a little bit easier, which is the point of technology, is to make the world better and for our lives to be easier. And we're seeing all sorts of, you know, women. One of the things that keeps me up at night is the way that public discourse is evolving online, particularly for women that have public profiles, and the way that AI tools are being used to discredit and to demean some of these women. And I think that that is that's a real challenge. I think the genie's out of the bottle there, and that needs a whole society response, from everything from education to content moderation to tech companies taking responsibility for what's posted. And I think the eSafety Commission in Australia and Julie Inman Grant's leadership is really driving that for Australia, and she's being very brave in what she's trying to do as well. So I think that the challenge is really clear, and I think the response required is really clear as well.
I think you're absolutely right, and thinking about that individual or organizational responsibilities and approaches as well, I think that can come down to also who you're inspired by. Jennifer Robinson is one person who springs to mind who's done a lot of work and been quite publicly present, particularly this year. But then I think also you can look at those organizational levels and look at people who are trying to lead the charge, and organizations that are trying to lead the charge in that way to make AI safer for women.
Absolutely. And tech organizations that are building out the trust and safety staff and resourcing, I think, are some of the success stories, and certainly some of the individuals that you've mentioned. And one for me is Jewel Bulwini, who founded the Algorithmic Justice League, that looked at the mitigation of biases in AI systems. And that was quite a few years ago. So we've already moved really quickly in terms of being able to address some of those inaccuracies, and that those limitations for AI, I think, now are quite well known, because I think we really normalize a lot of this technology. But when we look to the future and to more sophisticated learning capabilities for these systems, that's what I think we need to really critically interrogate, because the next generation, you know, they are entirely enmeshed in a digital life, and we owe them to have the building blocks in place now for those interactions to be safe. I think that, you know, a safe world is a safe online world, needs to be a safe online world as well. My current role, I mean, that's something that IBM's been doing for a long time, has been sort of in the AI game for many decades, and making sure that our large language models, as a lot of other tech organizations are, just making sure that they are fit for purpose and that they can be used without fear of being able to, without fear of biased outputs that we know were present in the early models.
Mm. And it's so important, I think, to get into, you know, what might seem on the outside like minutiae, but particularly in a large language model, the way in which we speak and the patterns of speech that are, you know, inherently different between the genders, it's incredibly important that we make sure that all of those are acknowledged and amalgamated within the technology.
It's true. And one of my favorite expressions of a ChatGPT type tool is that it's a calculator for words. So it will provide an answer based on the input, and it generates text. It doesn't write. It uses the computations and the combinations and permutations from the data model that it's been trained on to produce an outcome.
I absolutely love that. And as a writer by trade, that I cannot tell you how much hope that gave me for the future of people in my profession. I think that's an extraordinary way of putting it. And we've touched on this a little bit earlier on, but I'm interested to know your experience, you know, throughout your career and in your role now. I know that you're very committed to ensuring that particularly, you know, women are brought forward within the process of development of AI and within the tech world. Do you think that those tech advancements are enabling us to have more women in the room? And if not, how do we build applied AI to make sure that we are serving humanity better in that way?
Such an amazing question. And can I start from the top? I just wanted to agree absolutely around the way that we talk about AI in terms of a software tool. It's software. It's programmed. It has no free will of its own. And I think it's just important to acknowledge some of the different narratives around AI. And it's a decision support tool. So this IA or this applied AI helps us live our lives in a better way and helps us address some of the world's problems, ideally through ways that that we can only do through some of these deep learning and this automation technology. So in terms of the tech world and women in tech, women were the first computers, and somehow the sector has evolved to be male dominators over decades. But we did it, you know, did it all by hand, did it all, which is quite compelling to me. So I think that there's quite a long way to go, but I think there is agreement that you need diverse perspectives in rooms that create tech. So critical to have diverse perspectives and all genders represented in rooms that design AI. And then just through those normal development routes that we have, which is customer engagement and stakeholder groups and iterative design that allows to create products that then can be rapidly adapted as they needed to best fit the market. And I know that's very special, but this is the way that the sector operates a lot of the time. So I think it's critical to have women in the room, to have more women in the room. We want critical mass. I'm very used to sort of industries where there's been not very many women, and it's so important that we support each other and bring through the next generation as well. And I think the next generation sees things slightly differently, and I think they have demands of the workforce. So I welcome those demands to build a fairer, more equitable workplace for everyone.
Yeah, I think it's definitely something that I see as well. You know, in my role here, I see it day to day and more broadly across the tech sector as well. Absolutely, that the next generations all have very different and higher demands of the workplace. And, you know, I think technology to some extent can help to meet those. It would be so interesting to know, if we think sort of through your career, really, I think the thing that holds together, if we think Army and then really big organizations like IBM, they have reach and they have resource. So those things that bring them together, what are your experiences around organizations of those style with reach and resource? What's happening in that space to make sure that this diversity is being supported?
So I think the voices for diversity in those organizations are as loud as I've ever heard them. And that's a great development. And I think it's also becoming more normalized, which is terrific. So, you know, AI tools, we just spoke about ways of reducing bias through the recruitment program, and being able to kind of optimize those tools to make sure that you've got the fairest possible avenues to allow and to encourage more women to come in, to be workplaces of choice, to be able to compete in a very contested labor market. We welcome our grads and we want to bring them through the organization and bring them through and help them lead, you know, the IBM of the future. But I think in terms of reach and resources, so both the Defence Force has been leaning into robotics and autonomous systems and AI, and really following a lot of the work that's being done in the national stage with the National AI Center and data and CSO Data 61, and the work that's been done with the Department of Industry, Science and Resources and Digital Transformation Agency. So I think staying very linked with those organizations and then resource what you value.
What I'd love to do now is use your expertise and your lived experience to have a conversation about where you think AI is going to go, particularly around the context of women within AI. So I guess, how do you see the future panning out for women in AI, particularly in the Australian and APAC market? Are you optimistic? Do you have some skepticism around it? You know, in the areas that you have visibility over it, what do you see coming over the horizon?
I'd say that I'm a realistic optimist, which I know is sort of playing both sides. So I have a real grounded optimism about the future. And I think because we have this great evidence base to be inspired by, to keep building. And I see incredible female AI engineers, programmers, data scientists, data analysts, data engineers, and have had the privilege of working with them as well, in Australia and New Zealand and through APAC as well. And I think that if we can just keep building our numbers, I think that things are just going to get better and better.
You know, you said the future, you believe, you know, with some form of pragmatic optimism, can be really bright and really positive for AI if we can keep enough women involved in it. Using your experience and your own opinions, what do you think that's going to take? Do you is it systemic change? Is it upon the individual to lean in? How do you see those numbers, continuing and hopefully being driven up for women in AI?
And that's the question that we have to ask, is how do we get from here to there? Because I think everyone has the intent, but how to actually achieve it. And I think a lot of it is systemic and structural drivers within organizations that need to be committed to hiring technical women and being supportive and bringing them through the organizations and giving them every opportunity to succeed to the most senior levels of business. So I think individual, certainly I think knowing yourself and knowing what you're interested in, knowing what your strengths are, and advocating for yourself as an individual, like not self-selecting out because you're not sure that you don't have all the qualifications, just giving it a go. But I think that there's a huge corporate responsibility and a social license to operate piece here around corporations that need to be thinking differently about how they have more women in their organization, and how we get to gender parity in technology, because that's going to build more opportunities. And once those pipelines are better entrenched, then it's going to become easier for everyone.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. It's such a huge topic, thinking about, AI for good. Do you think its potential impact is overblown, or really we've not even started to touch the sides yet? You've got this experience with huge organizations, future planning and capabilities. How do you navigate and help your organizations to navigate this uncertainty that AI is sort of making inherent in our day-to-day lives?
And I think uncertainty is a great term because I think it's applicable to everyone in every sector. And it's, the saying goes that things are moving at their slowest right now. The pace of change is only going to accelerate. I always think about sort of what's come in history, and when we think about the pace of change, we've moved very quickly in history before, and there's always been uncertainty, and there's been huge global events that have been destabilizing. So we've got everything we need. It's all in front of us. We just have to not make the same mistakes that we have. So around uncertainty and decision-making, because I think, that's the business that we're all in. We're actually making decisions. We're making change. But I think one of my favorite models is the Gartner's hype cycle. So it's very important to chat about while we're talking about AI. And it starts with, it talks about the peak of inflated expectations, and then it drops into the trough of disillusionment, and then it eventually gets to the plateau of productivity. So we sort of say, as tech professionals, our job is to move from the left to the right as fast as possible and to iron out these big curves. So we're just getting to the new tool, we're being productive with the new tool, and we're looking at what's next. So I think uncertainty is around confidence in making decisions when you don't have all the information, tracking the trends and being confident in what you do know, identifying the gap analysis and finding out what you don't, and then being able to be part of the conversations that continue to iterate technology and make it better and make it more fit for purpose, and then have an eye on the future about what's coming and what we're going to lean into, because no one knows, there's geopolitics is, there's a lot of destabilizing factors at the moment, but I think being really clear about individually as well as corporate in your values and your mission and your purpose, and then putting all your energy and your weight behind it in order to help realize those goals.
Yeah, I think a lot of that makes so much sense. And a couple of things that you said really should resonate for us on the macro and the micro level, talking around looking at what's happened historically and learning from both the wins and the mistakes and not repeating the mistakes. I think, of course it works on a macro level, and we hope that the powers that be in society follow that same rule. But from an uncertainty perspective for each of us to deal with on a day-to-day basis, a lot of the conversations that I have in my networks, particularly in tech and particularly within Australia at the moment, that sense of uncertainty, it's inherent in the industry. So whilst we accept it and we understand it, recently I think it has become a little you know, more pronounced than it has been before. So I think these tips are so strong for a lot of what you say, Kate, and the way in which you say it feels like, okay, take a deep breath, take a step back and look at the broader picture of what's happening. Yes, there is uncertainty, but nothing here is completely new. A lot of similar situations have happened before. And if we take learnings from each of those moments in our lives or, you know, in the broader lived experience, we actually probably have got enough information to then put it all together and make ourselves a path.
Yes, I think so. And getting yourself one's village, just having and building your village. And being able to negotiate it with friends and colleagues just sort of makes it all a little bit more doable.
I think so. And often, you know, your village can help you with a sense of momentum because, you know, when you're feeling uncertain about something, it's easy to get stuck in that and allow uncertainty or fear to kind of stop you in your tracks. You know, and it can go hand in hand with, you know, you're worried that you can't get something perfect. You're uncertain about the situation full stop. So you become trapped.
Yes. And I think that paralysis through analysis is a very clear danger. And the innovation failure, you know, that's how you get to innovation is through rapid failure. And a lot of the sentiment is around fail fast, fail cheaply, fail early in order to get to that incremental design. And this is all adaptation. When people talk about, and I love having these conversations around, you know, what's a game changer? Because I don't think AI is a game changer. I think it's iterative. But, you know, the robots still have to be programmed.
So talk us through that, unpack that a bit for us. It comes partially, I understand, from it's been around for a long time. What we're in at the moment is, you know, in the terms we're talking about now, what we're in at the moment is an iteration of AI. So tell us why you think that.
One of the things that I love about studying AI is that it's, for me, it's a study about what it means to be human. And these parallels move together. So as the AI gets smarter or gets more capable, the humans need to get more smarter, more capable, because there are things that IA can never do. So it can automate and it can time save, but it doesn't have, programs don't have creativity or judgment or empathy. They could advise ways of taking action and ways of making decisions, but there are things that only humans can do. And I think being very clear about what technology can do to aid humans and humanity is part of this, the social responsibility that we have. And I think for AI and for emerging technology, there's the most incredible Indigenous speculative fiction right now that talks about different ways of considering time and different ways of being. And I'm not doing it any justice, but I think that it's important to think about different perspectives and the way that things can go, because technology is often criticized as being quite binary in terms of it's utopian or it's dystopian. And neither of those things are ever really exist in their extremes by themselves. They're always in combination. So for AI, one of our roles, I think, is to refute AI and is to be very clear about where AI is not needed or not helping, you know, is not aiding productivity or is not doing what it's supposed to, is not assisting with what it's supposed to be doing in accordance with our values and what we need it to be doing. And I say that with a lens of being involved in some of the laws of armed conflict and some of the autonomous system development that we've seen around drones and the ongoing conversations that are having internationally to just make sure that the rules of engagement are still in accordance with the ways that we choose to conduct conflict and making sure that we aren't letting autonomous systems operate without the human who's making the decision.
Is that something you're in a position to be able to talk any more about?
So for me, one of the phrases that stays with me about AI and what it is it's a knife. And so a knife can be used in all types of scenarios. It can be used to conduct a crime, but it's very difficult to make dinner without it. So we can use technology for good or for other reasons, and we're seeing all sorts of interesting and concerning, you know, things that are happening online around misinformation and deep fakes and that sort of aspect. So certainly very aware of what, and don't want to minimize, you know, the ways that, that these tools can be used. And guardrails and controls being absolutely pivotal. We've seen so much work being done with the way that nation states and regions are dealing with AI. There's a sort of a provocative point of view short film on YouTube. It's called Slaughterbots. It's from a couple of years ago. It's about 8 minutes long.
Did you say Slaughterbots?
Slaughterbots. That's Slaughterbots. Right.
I'm writing it down and I will put it in the notes, everybody. Yep.
Thank you. It's, don't watch it late at night.
Good tip for beginners. It, look, in the title, it doesn't sound like, you know, super fun, well, light watching. Yeah.
In the daytime, in the sunshine. But it's a dystopian provocative point of view that was made before there was a UN convention about autonomous systems in warfare that basically presents a future view where there are nanobots that are that can be controlled and that are used for, you know, for assassinations and for the application of violence by the nation state. And it's quite challenging because it does basically present a point of view that machines or autonomous systems are capable of its own decision making using technology in terms of, you know, geolocation tracking and ID and identification of individuals in war or civil unrest. So I think that these kind of artistic interpretations are important for opposing these points of view and being able to ensure that we're having the conversations that we need to have.
I think that's fascinating, and I want to leave a couple of beats because what I'm about to say, I realise, doesn't follow immediately on, or does it? One of the really interesting things that I took from that conversation is also that that is the exact storyline of Big Hero 6, the kids' film, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought, wow, that's actually, and it's really interesting because, you know, having watched that a number of times, how fascinating that already that storytelling exists on so many different planes, you know, from a very dystopian piece that you are outlining, which none of us can watch late at night, through to, you know, a box office smash, you know, really designed for families and kids, but absolutely tells you that those stories are being spoken about, you know, that reality's out there already for open discussion. I'm so grateful to you for bringing that broader context to us, because I think that when I first came across you and was interested in having you on the podcast, what interests me so much about you is really your lived experience. You have an experience that is shaped by really having made the types of decisions that most of us don't have to think about on a day-to-day basis and taken that logical thinking to that extent. I think that's quite profound, that it's a very useful starting point for, you know, the rest of us who are not living in that reality.
And I love your point about Big Hero 6. So it was thinking about the film and also the film WALL-E. So the last...
Yeah!
How about who humans are in WALL-E?
Yes.
See picture. When we've allowed humanity to just lose its curiosity and its drive to improve, and we all end up just watching screens all day and drinking our protein shakes and not even walking anymore.
That's such an interesting sidebar. I shall go and examine that at some length. Kate, I really want to ask you. We have these three questions, which you may be familiar with. We ask each of our guests on Flip the Focus to answer them. So what I'd love to ask you is, what advice would you give women who are looking to get into tech right now, the future generations you've spoken of, people who are starting out and maybe it's the first job? What would you say to them?
I'd say be curious, be bold, and advocate for your own ideas.
It's great guidance, whatever career that you're going into. But I think that curiosity and boldness, so important with any form of creative role. And of course, you know, technology is inherently so. Love that. Secondly, I'm going to give you a magic wand. So like full on magic, not AI. And if you could vanquish or validate any aspect of the tech landscape specifically for women, what would it be and why would you do that?
we'd had gender parity in tech. And I think that that is like absolutely critical for where we're going, because so much of tech is held and bound by very small percentages of the world. And they are just getting more and more powerful. And I think we need women at the most senior levels of decision making in business and the tech industry.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think it's absolutely essential. And I think that it feels as though, well, certainly we know the statistics show that progress is happening. It just feels agonizingly slow for those of us trying to help it happen. Finally, if each of our listeners could walk away today and just do three really small, immediately actionable things that can be as tiny as, a particular person you think they should be following on LinkedIn or a particular story that they should tell, what would those three things be?
So I think, under the theme of connection and learning from others and learning from each other, I think on LinkedIn there's a number of organizations that you can follow if you're not already. The National AI Center is really important. TSIRO and Data 61 is really important. If there's one person to learn about as a next step, I'm going to offer Distinguished Professor Genevieve Bell, who's the Vice Chancellor of ANU. She's a remarkable leader and a woman in tech who has led the need for AI to be safe, responsible, and sustainable for decades. She's a cultural anthropologist, spent 20 years at Intel in Silicon Valley in the US. She spoke about what it is to be a digital Australian citizen and in the 2017 ABC Boyer Lectures. And she created a new school at ANU, which is the School of Cybernetics, which talks about interdisciplinary requirements for technology and how to build this digital world that we all want to live in. And now she's the VC of ANU. So
thank you so much for talking to us today, Kate. That was genuinely fascinating. And I've got so much going on in my brain right now that I'm going to go and distill and hopefully bring to bear. It was a genuinely fascinating conversation.
That's it for episode one. And I am sure that you will agree that Kate is absolutely incredible. She really made me realize, as so often with these things, something as big and as fast moving as AI, oftentimes we really get pulled into the day to day, and zooming way back out to the macro picture is just as interesting and just as necessary for all of us to do. And Kate put it so well, we all use applied AI every day, and that can and should be a way to make our lives easier. With that comes the ability and the responsibility to consider where AI should not go in our lives and the lives of the society around us too, and thinking about where it isn't making life better or simpler. Look, as part of the conversation, there were so many great references that Kate brought up, so we've put them all into the show notes for you to get into. Now, next time, I'm talking to a woman who absolutely blew my mind. Her AI knowledge and application and use of it in the media space for tech media is just extraordinary. Really looking forward to sharing it with you. Don't forget to rate and review us in the meantime, and drop me a DM on LinkedIn if you're keen to join the listener group. See you next time.